Welcome to the Herpetile Podcast. My name is Nash and I love herpetology. This podcast explores all things to do with reptiles and amphibians. I hope you like it. Welcome to the show. My name is Nash and I'm the host of the Herpetile Podcast. My guest today is Dr. Georgia Ward-Fear. Georgia is a conservation scientist, reptile biologist, and explorer from a young age. Georgia does research on pests and invasive species. In 2017, Georgia developed the Cane Toad Coalition, which is a partnership between conservation organizations, indigenous NGOs, and cultural groups, state governments, and regional stakeholders. Welcome to my show, Georgia.
Thanks for having me, Nash.
Good to have you too. My first question is, how and when did you first become interested in working with animals?
Well, I've always loved animals. I've always been fascinated by their lifestyles, and I've always been interested in trying to see as many different types of animals as I could. I always paid attention to them when I was a young kid on bushwalks and things.
Yeah.
And I feel really lucky that I get to work with them for a job, because when I was a kid, I just had a really strong interest in them, kind of like you, I guess. And I just kind of kept that became a hobby for me, working, looking out for animals in the environment and kind of learning a lot about them. And I wanted to be a vet originally. Yes. And then when I did work experience in high school, I realized that I love all animals, but when I worked at the vets, I realised that actually I wanted to work with wild animals or with native animals in the wilderness. Yeah. And that's kind of what really, kept my passion burning. I did biology in school all through high school. And then after high school, I did science at university and became a biologist. So I feel really lucky. Sometimes I pinch myself with the things that I get to do. And actually get paid for it, get to work at it as a job.
Do you like go out herping much?
Yeah, I do. I spend about half of my year away, in the field. Yeah. So doing field work, doing my research, and that's done across Northern Australia. And through the course of that work, because I work a lot with reptiles, I see a lot of reptiles, so I work with crocodiles and goannas and snakes and lizards and other small lizards, small skinks. So I kind of get my herping fix through that. I probably don't go herping that much when I'm back down in the office.
Do you do any veterinary stuff or?
I don't do any. Well, I do kind of. I mean, I have, as a researcher, over nearly 10 years now, I have had to do little like mini operations and things that I'm trained for through the course of my work. Things like putting transmitters into snakes and lizards, where you have to do a small operation on them and then you release them and then you can track them again. You can follow them because they've got a transmitter now that you can track with equipment. So I have done experiments in veterinary work in that sense, but I've never actually worked as a vet.
So not really like treating sick animals or anything.
I have done a bit of wires work before where if you get sick wildlife and then you kind of nurse them to health and you try and release them back into the wild. So I am trained to do that as well. But I have done that in my spare time in the past. But no, I say day to day, I don't really do that work.
What did make you become interested in working with invasive species? Your work is to do with invasive species?
Yes, correct. It is. Well, as I said, I wanted to work with animals in the wild, and so I have done a lot of work with animals looking at what we call ecology, which is about, it's kind of basic biology, so learning about the animals themselves, their life cycles and what they do at different times of the year, their behaviour, and then also ecology looks at how they interact with other animals and in the environment, the ecosystem. Yeah. And even plants. So it kind of looks at how all of the living things in an area interact. And I love that work. But having when you start working with wild animals in the wild, it's quite a natural progression. It felt like a natural progression for me to then want to help animals that were struggling or species that were under threat by different things.
Because of invasive species, like the animals that are under threat because of invasive species?
Definitely. So there's many things that can cause issues for species in the wild, and there could be things like pollution. Say, for example, pollution in water means that certain species struggle to survive, fish and things like that. But it can also be invasive species, and so that's where I have done a lot of research, looking at how invasive species actually, you know, what they do to the environments that they come into.
So when you're studying about invasive species and ecosystems, you'd be like seeing what how they affect the ecosystems.
Yep, definitely how they affect the ecosystem, and then if there's anything that we can do to try and decrease that impact on the ecosystem. So the interesting thing is, not all invasive species are bad. So invasive species is an animal or a plant that has come from somewhere else. So it's not native to the area, usually from a different country. And so there's kind of this mismatch with the environment that they come into. And often because they haven't evolved in that environment, they often don't have predators or the things that naturally keep them in check in their native systems. And so they can, they can produce rapidly and then kind of swamp an ecosystem, or they can be things like even animals that we consider really good in our society, like cats and horses, when they're in the wild, they actually cause a lot of damage to the environment. So horses can, because they've got hard hooves, and Australia has no animals that have hard hooves. And so we don't, our soil and many of our native burrowing animals, you know, they get really heavily impacted by things like horses and cattle. And the same with cats, since they've been released into the wild, they cause huge amounts of deaths in our native animals, which have not evolved to have that kind of cat-like predator in the environment.
Yeah, like birds and stuff.
Yeah, birds and a lot of our small little rodents. And our little kind of groups of animals that are like in the kind of bigger kangaroo family. But they're much smaller, bilbies and things like that too.
So then you're talking about that that is how invasive species affect native wildlife?
Yes, that is. So there's many ways that invasive species can impact native wildlife. But because there's many different ways that they impact, there's also many opportunities for us to try and intervene and decrease the impact that they have on native wildlife. And that was really where my kind of interest, where my interest grew from, was looking at, I'm a very solutions focused person, and I like to look at ways that I can try and help our native wildlife.
What made you start the Cane Toad Coalition?
That's a good question. So one of the species that I have worked on a lot in my career are cane toads. So when I was talking before about, horses, they do physical damage to the environment, and cats, actually kill native animals. Well, cane toads kill native animals as well, but in a different way. Cane toads come from South America, and they produce this poison that comes out of the back of their neck, and that is a defense mechanism that they have that stops animals in their native environment from eating them. And it's very fast acting, because it's supposed to be that, an animal comes, it grabs a toad, and then the toad gets scared and releases this toxin on the back of its head, and it's very distasteful for the animals. And in the native, in a cane toad's native home, those animals would just drop the toad and then they just carry on and about their business. But in Australia, because there's no, our animals have no history with the cane toad or any members of the toad family, they are very, that toxin actually kills them over here. And so the cane toads were introduced to try and stop sugarcane, like pest beetles of the sugarcane fields in Queensland. And they didn't do that at all. And instead they've actually rapidly spread, and they are causing huge, issues for some of our native predators.
So
they kind of kill animals in a different way. They kill animals because the native animals try and attack them and then they die from the toxin.
I think I read in a book that the native Australian keelback snake can eat cane toads.
Yes, they can. So as I, you know, the main animals that are impacted by cane toads are the elapid snakes, the poisonous snakes, the Australian poisonous snakes. The, you know, goannas, all goanna species, get hit really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And freshwater crocodiles and some, like, frill-neck lizards as well in some areas.
Yeah.
So actually it's the reptilian predators that suffer the biggest declines from cane toads. There's also the quoll, which gets heavily impacted as well. But that's one of the only mammal species that does actually get impacted.
So what is the purpose of the cane toad coalition then?
So the coalition was, I decided to set up the coalition because I'd worked in the past on ways to try and decrease the impact of cane toads by trying to stop cane toads themselves, trying to decrease the numbers of the cane toads themselves in the environment. And a lot of research has been put into that area, but there's not actually much we can do about the cane toads, about their invasion. They just breed in such high numbers. You know, one female can lay 30,000 eggs twice a year. So that's a lot of toads that come from one toad. So they just, you know, only 100 toads were brought into Australia, only 100 adult toads. And all the cane toads we see have come from those 100 toads. So anyway, so research has been focused on trying to stop the cane toads, which is usually what you do in when you're working with invasive species. You try and work with the invasive species itself.
Yeah.
But more recently, we started to look at other ways that we could decrease the impact of cane toads on native wildlife. And anyway, I decided I wanted to start this big conservation project focused on that exact question. And so conservation, you know, you need lots of people to be working in conservation, coming together. And you need people from different backgrounds because it's really big problems that you're trying to solve. And it really helps to have lots of different brains and backgrounds on the job so that you can really attack it from all angles. So the Cane Toad Coalition, as you said in the beginning, is a group of organisations. So it's the West Australian government and there's conservation organisations. There's private pastoralists, so private landholders in Northern Australia. And then there's also the Indigenous representative bodies, what we call the land councils, the Kimberley Land Council.
Yeah.
And then there's also the Indigenous rangers and communities themselves. And all of these groups have different reasons for wanting to get involved in the conservation program. And I brought them all together in what we call the Cane Toad Coalition so that we all work together on this problem and we share our knowledge and we share our skills. And, you know, sometimes I can't always be up in Northern Australia, but then my partners are up there at the moment, so then they can do the work when I'm not there.
How you do this, do you, what is your technique for training the native predators?
Well, that's it. You just kind of named it. As I said, we had been working on trying to stop the cane toads themselves, but that hasn't worked. And so we're working with the actual predators themselves and we're training the predators to not to eat cane toads, which is quite a kind of a novel, kind of cutting edge strategy.
Is that taste aversion or is it?
Yeah, that's called taste aversion. So the best way to describe taste aversion is food poisoning.
Yeah.
So if you've had a bad experience with some food that was a little bit off and you didn't know, and then you got sick and then you never, you know, after that, even the thought of that food and just, you know, makes you want to gag, like you can't even think about eating it. Well, that's, that food poisoning response. Animals have that as well. And the reason they have that is so that if they eat something in their environment that's toxic or a bit off, that they won't eat it again. It's this mechanism that is deep inside them that means that they will never eat. You know, they'll never be poisoned again.
Yeah.
And so reptiles have this too. So we just harnessed that ability in native animals. And what we do is we actually go ahead of the cane toad invasion. So at the front of the cane toad invasion, as it moves through, it's these really large adult toads, and every toad that an animal meets will kill it because it's got so much toxin in it. And our animals only have to, you know, a goanna only has to mouth the toad for, say, 10 seconds, and then it will die. That's how poisonous cane toads are to these animals. And so what we did was, what we do is we go just ahead of the cane toad invasion. When the toad invasion is about to hit a population within the next couple of months, and we release baby cane toads, which are not toxic enough. They're not big enough and not toxic enough to kill the animals. And so we release those baby cane toads, which we call teacher toads. And so the animals have an experience with that toad, that small toad that makes them sick, but it doesn't kill them. And so they actually have the opportunity to develop that food poisoning response. And then when the big front arrives, the big invasion front arrives, they remember that experience with the small toad, and then they don't eat the large toads, and then they survive. And that we've shown that works with all of the predators that are impacted. So quolls, and then even crocs and goannas, and other animals, we've shown that works. And so now we're actually rolling it out ahead of the front line,
Happens if you're a bit further ahead of the front line than you usually would be, and you released some teacher toads, and what if they grew up to mating size, and before they actually got there, and then they just boosted the population?
That's a very good consideration, Nash, and that's something that we had to, before we started this strategy, we had to really sit down and calculate and consider what the risks were to doing this strategy. Yeah. Like in all conservation, you need to do these big calculations to work out what we call the cost to benefit. So if you're doing something like that, you know, releasing small toads, what is the likely impact of that on the system? And is that a bigger cost than what's about to come and happen with the cane toad invasion? So it's a very important consideration. What we've done is design the strategy so that with the biology of the toads in mind. So, you know, frogs need water and toads need water.
Yeah.
And so what we do is we release the small toads right at the beginning of the wet season, where there's water bodies, but they're small, you know, they're like a pond or, you know, or a river or something. And the baby toads have to stay close to those that water spot. They can't actually move very far away. We're talking tiny. They're like the size of your small fingernail. So they can't actually move away from that water source at that age. So that there's not a risk that they're going to disperse and kind of move the front any further than it will be.
Yeah.
Another thing is that animals, whilst they can learn, they need to have that learning experience within a shorter time period as possible. So we don't want to release the small toads and then, you know, then the goannas don't meet the invasion front for another year, because we risk them not remembering that experience with the small toad. And so what we do is we have all across the Kimberley, we have people monitoring the cane toad front line by doing surveys, nighttime surveys, where they go to waterholes and they spotlight and they listen out for toads and they look for tadpoles. And we have people doing that all across the Kimberley so that we can work out exactly where the front line is. And we're basically tracking the front line through the wet season and the wet season previous to the one that we're about to do the releases. And then we release the toads only, small toads only, when we know that the adult toads are within, will arrive within the next month.
Yeah.
So basically the short answer to that question is we never release the small toads very far ahead of the invasion front.
So how far ahead would it be?
The cane toad invasion front is moving at about 50 kilometres a year, which is crazy for considering that this is a, you know, these are frogs basically. They're moving 50 kilometres a year.
Yeah.
And the way that we calculate it is when we start seeing the first deaths in animals, we will release within 20 kilometres of the front line.
Okay.
So it's not very far at all. And we're kind of restricted to where the water holes are. We have to release the toads around water holes. But that's also where a lot of the animals are that that get impacted by cane toads as well. So that works out well.
So you work with Indigenous rangers and communities. What special knowledge can they contribute to this work?
One of the most exciting parts of my work is the fact that I get to work with all of the Indigenous ranger groups across the Kimberley. I love it. I've learnt so much as a biologist. You know, I've learnt so much through university about science and, you know, my own passion about herpetology and animals. But no one else could teach me what I've learnt from the rangers except the rangers themselves. The project works with all of the rangers ahead of the front line in the Kimberley, and I've lived and spent a lot of time with different ranger groups and different communities. And I guess you've just got to ask yourself, you know, if these people have been living on the land, on the country there for, you know, they're saying, you know, close to 100,000 years.
Yeah.
They just have such a deep knowledge of the countryside that where their, you know, their cultural group is from.
Yeah.
The ecology of the area, the animals that they live with, and that they have, many of these species are really important bush food.
Yeah.
So they know so much about their ecology, about their seasonal movements, when is best to hunt them, and also larger long-term cycles. So we think of the you know, cycles as yearly, and we think of like spring, summer, autumn, winter. But, you know, for example, the Yaru people in Broome, they actually have 12 seasons in the year, 12 seasons. And those seasons are based on really small, kind of more subtle changes in the environment, like when certain flowers come in, and you know, that when those certain flowers are flowering, then it means that the sea turtles will also be laying their eggs on the coast. And so it's all interlinked. It's a deep ecological knowledge. And so having access to that when you're doing research is amazing. It's like you've got an in. You've got into the secrets of the environment that you're working in. It's really, really
so
great.
Then,
and the skills as well, the skills that they
so
have.
So then how successful is the Cane Toad Coalition's work?
Well, I mean, it's research, so it's kind of ongoing. Every year we get different, we get more data, and it's a kind of an ongoing project that we need to monitor. But it is successful. It's been really successful to date. We've worked for 2 years, and we've covered a lot of areas across the Kimberley where we've done these teacher toad releases, and we've gone and monitored the populations, and they're all doing well. Yeah, and it's had lots of really good outreach in science. So it's one thing to do science by yourself as a researcher, but then it's another thing to actually share that science with the world. And that's what we call outreach. And it's really important for scientists to share their results and to actually include other people in science and in research so that it increases everyone's knowledge. So we've done lots of outreach. We're having this training sessions for the Cane Toad Coalition and all of the ranger groups where we're deciding what the strategy is. We work on a seasonal basis, so this is this wet season, and then we'll be starting to prepare for next wet season. So we're strategizing about how we're going to do that, which areas we're going to go into, and how we're going to ramp up the learning and skills that everyone has, which are necessary for this project.
So do you think that cane toads will ever spread across all of Australia, or do you think you're going to keep them back?
I think that the only thing that's going to stop cane toads is the environment that is the environmental constraints. So cane toads need water, and so they won't be able to penetrate that far into the desert. It's kind of things like that. And the same with cold environments. They'll only be a certain distance that they'll be able to travel down, you know, down south before it gets too cold for them to survive.
So we're getting a bit off the cane toad topic. Do you have a favourite reptile or amphibian species?
That is a very hard question. I love that question, but it's very hard, isn't it, when you love herps. I've got, you know, I would say that my favourite group of reptiles is dependent on the season that I'm working, because, you know, they come out at different seasons, they're doing different things at different seasons, at different times of the year. So I would say my favourite snake would be the black-headed python.
Yeah.
I love black-headed pythons, and I love going out and trying to find them out in northern, up in Darwin, in, around Darwin. Yeah. But I would say probably my favourite group of herps are the goannas. I would consider myself somewhat of a goanna specialist. I've worked with them for quite a few years now, and they're just a fascinating group.
Do you keep any animals?
I don't keep any animals myself. I have in the past kept, you know, I've had blue tongue before, and also a bearded dragon, which were great little animals to keep. Yeah. But I haven't, I don't have any reptile pets at the moment. But, you know, when I was doing my PhD, I was radio tracking over 100 goannas at that time. And so I like to think that I did have actually 100 goannas as pets.
So you travelled thousands of kilometres in a sea kayak to live with the people in the Pacific Islands. Why did you do that?
Why did I do that? That's a good question. I am really interested in experiencing other cultures around the world.
Yeah.
And visit. And I've actually, you know, my passion for animals has taken me to many parts of the world and travelled to lots of different places almost to see, you know, just to see different animals.
Yeah.
And because I've done that, I've then got to be with other cultures as well. But I have a strong interest in Indigenous cultures, and it's because a lot of Indigenous cultures have similar values to me.
Yeah.
As a biologist, you know, we really care about nature. We really feel a strong sense of a duty to protect nature, and a strong understanding of nature, you know, a wide understanding of nature. And so I have travelled to live with many Indigenous cultures around the world. And also I wanted to learn from them. I wanted to learn.
What
from,
did you learn?
From, did I learn? I would say one of the biggest things I learned was that happiness is not attached to material things.
Yeah.
People in the Pacific Islands are just so happy. But by our standards, they would have very little, you know, they live in grass huts, and they, you know, have extensive vegetable gardens, and they catch all their own food, and that's all they have. They've got their families, and they're just so happy. So actually sometimes simplicity is brings a lot more joy, and, you know, then I think we get weighed down with a lot of material stuff. And actually some of the happiest times in my life have been when I've been living in a tent for months on end. I kayaked around the Pacific Islands.
So you go to like the very remote sort of civilizations?
Yeah, we have. My partner and I, Miles, my husband, mm-hmm. he actually built a kayak that could hold two people, and we traveled around, and it actually, he painted on two big eyes on the front of it, so it looked like a sea creature, and people just were so surprised to see us coming around the corner. But we learned the language too, which is called Pidgin English.
Oh, wow.
So kind of a mix of English and yeah, I mean, just for the people in the Pacific Islands, the villages, your story is everything. Your story is like money. So everywhere you go, you have to tell your story about who you are, your life, your interests, and then they tell their stories back to you. And it's just this beautiful thing where it's just about, you know, human connection, and, you know, and it's kind of what we're doing now, you know, talking about our passions, and it's an exchange that really, you know, is really important.
Is that language very complicated?
It's not that complicated, but Ale, bami tokem you fella naya, bami tokem pidgin English naya, you may stop tokem lo reptile.
So, like, some of the words are similar?
You can kind of pick up some words, but some words are, you know, like, mm-hmm. the language is... Pidgin English is actually a language that evolved when it's got a bit of a sad history, but basically I can't remember, it might have been the 1800s, when the sugarcane plantations were big, they would actually go around, ships would go around to the Pacific mm-hmm. Islands and get people to come on board, and then they would bring them back to Australia and make them work in the sugarcane fields. And so you had all these people from Papua New Guinea and Solomon Islands and Vanuatu, and they made up their own language, which was a mix of English and French and things like that, because they all spoke different languages then. So that language group is, you can hear all across the Pacific Islands. So I've been to the Solomon Islands and Vanuatu. And, yeah, we have gone out to very remote places. And
so if you could tell everyone in the world something about reptiles or amphibians, what would it be?
You know, I think that reptiles are quite misunderstood by the world, really. I think that they're very ancient lineage, and they're different. People struggle. I think a lot of the reason people are scared of reptiles is because they can't read them, you know. Part of being a biologist, it's really important to know how to read animals, and as we say, and so you need to kind of be around them enough, or handling them enough, or just observing them enough to know when they're stressed or when they're angry. And I think the average person doesn't know that. They don't spend enough time with them. But the thing is about reptiles is that even though they're ancient, they're not simple. You know, they live really interesting lives. And we think of them as these animals that are below the mammal group, but they're not. They live really complex lives, have just a really complex mating strategies and seasonal activities and behaviours. And so, yeah, I guess that's what I would tell people, is just that they're more complex than you think, and they're actually more interesting than you think.
Okay, I have one final question for you.
Yeah?
What is an unusual fact about reptiles or amphibians that people might not know?
I would say that kind of what I was just saying then was that reptiles can have really interesting behavior, and they can live really complex lives. That they do have this kind of almost like a drama. You know, for my PhD, when I was radio tracking goannas, I got to know them, you know, because you study them for PhDs 3 years. So I was tracking them for over 3 years. And so they all had names, because we couldn't remember them by number. So we gave them all names so that we could remember who they were and what they were doing. And so it was almost like a soap opera, you know. You'd find that, Mr. Whippy had been dating Sylvia. And then, 2 weeks later, he was over with Mary. And then, you know, Mary was nesting, and she was sharing the same, the same nest as Tilly. And yeah, they do have really interesting lives. And, and you see, like the young goannas, the young male goannas, you'd be tracking them in the home range every week, and then all of a sudden they'd vanish, and you thought that they may have died. But then actually you find that that they're just further up the floodplain. They've had to disperse to get out of the territory, to find new territory for themselves. And then they have dramas with the pythons, with the black-headed pythons and the olive pythons, who lived on the side of the escarpment. And then they would actually come down, and the pythons, and they'd come and hunt on the floodplain, and they'd just travel up and down the rivers where the goannas lived near. And then they would catch a goanna, and then they'd sit there for a few days, and then they would just, digest the food, and then they would take off back up to the escarpment. So the goannas were also having these dramas with these pythons that were constantly trying to get them. And the only reason we knew that was because once the python had eaten the goanna, then the tracker stayed inside the python until it kind of pooed it out. So we were able to then track pythons and see what the pythons were doing. Yeah. I mean, I can tell you, it was pretty scary thinking, the first time that I went and tracked I was tracking a goanna, and then it turned out to be like a 2.5 meter olive python. That was pretty scary. Yeah. So that, I guess, yeah, that I'm really interested in reptile behavior. And there's a growing body of research in science that's starting to focus on reptiles. So even in science, for a long time, people didn't think that reptiles were very interesting in that respect. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast, Georgia.
Thanks, Nash.
It was wonderful to have you.
It was wonderful to be here. I'm really inspired by your curiosity. I think that's probably the one thing that's given me the life that I've had, is this, that I was always curious, and I nurtured that curiosity, and I still nurture it today. And I think it's what makes a good scientist. But even if you don't become a scientist, curiosity is really I think what really can make your life very exciting. So yeah, good on you.
Thanks. See you later.
Thanks for listening to the Herpa Tower podcast. Please subscribe so you don't miss out on any of the latest episodes. Happy herping!